Weather in the Vertical, a presentation by Ed Williams. This presentation is brought to you by the Flying Particles Incorporated. The presentation by Ed Williams is copyright 2008 by Ed Williams, all rights reserved. The production by LBMG Music is copyright 2008 by LBMG Music, all rights reserved. During the presentation, I'll tell you the PDF slide number to select. Please select slide 1 for display and be ready to advance to the next slide. I hope you enjoy this presentation of Weather in the Vertical. And now, our speaker.
So this is the first of a pair of talks that are strongly related. So the next one will be given next month. And they're both about weather in the vertical. And
slide 2.
So what's this all about? Well, in particular, why is the vertical and temperature and moisture profile of the atmosphere so important? Well, that's sort of an issue of weather theory, and in particular, the temperature profile determines the stability of the atmosphere, whether or not it's stable to convection currents. And whether or not it's stable determines to a very large extent the kind of weather you'd expect to see. So we'll be talking today about atmospheric stability, what it means, how you'd come about determining whether it was stable or not, and what the characteristics of stable and unstable weather are. Next month, we'll be looking, with this background, we'll be looking at how to use these vertical soundings, as they're called, the temperature and dew point profiles of the atmosphere, plotted on what are called skew T plots, to augment our weather briefings. And we'll show that you can use them to tell you a lot of things about cloud layers, cloud tops, the potential for thunderstorms, potential for icing, fog, mountain waves, lots of things. And although these skew T plots have been around for probably the best part of a century,
slide 3.
What has happened in the last few years is that, first of all, they're much more available to pilots because you can get them on the internet. And secondly, there's a very nice tool that's interactive, a Java-based thing, which you can click and get information from. And so you don't have to know nearly as much about actually have to use the thing if you learn how to point and click. And so that's what we'll be talking about. So why should you be listening? Well, weather theory is good for you because to understand what's happening, it really does help to know why. I mean, you can just look out there and say, oh, it's a nice day, or it's not a nice day. But if you've got some concept of why it's getting better or why it's getting worse or why the weather looks the way it is, then you're less likely to be taken by surprise if the weather changes. And we almost certainly don't have the skill and the knowledge of a professional meteorologist, but up there in the air flying along, we do have the advantage of being right on the spot in real time, observing the weather, and we see things happening differently to the way they were forecast. If we have some understanding about how weather processes work, maybe we'll have some guess as to whether that's a bad thing or a good thing, and what we need to do about it.
Slide 4.
So, the general subject in meteorology is called parcel theory. Parcel theory is a tool that meteorologists use, forecasters in particular, to assess the possibility of vertical motion in the atmosphere. And why does vertical motion matter so much? Well, because if you take some air and you lift it, then it goes to lower pressure, it expands, it cools. And if the air cools, if it's got moisture in it, then that moisture can condense. So if you add vertical motion to moisture in the atmosphere, you'll create clouds. If you cool those clouds some more by lifting them some more, then that moisture will condense out in the form of precipitation, rain or drizzle or snow, whatever. With sufficient vertical motion, you get clouds that have extensive vertical development, building up into the 10s, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50,000 feet. And then you then you have the potential for thunderstorms. Vertical motion also affects icing. If your air is rising, then those little water droplets that condense are being lifted upwards and held up there in the atmosphere, being lifted into colder air. And if you fly along, those supercool droplets will be larger if you've got updrafts to hold them up than if they're just sitting there waiting to fall. So the air's response to being lifted is determined by what is by its stability. And we assess this by hypothetically lifting what are called parcels of air. So parcels are sort of imaginary bubbles of air. You take some lump of air and imagine you put it in saran wrap and you lift it. And you lift it up and you don't allow it to mix with its neighbors because you've got a nice little coating on it, and you don't allow it to exchange heat or air with its neighbors. And you ask, what does it do? So these sort of hypothetical lumps of air are called parcels. Real lumps of air, well, when they get lifted, these other effects that I mentioned, a little bit of mixing around the edges, a little bit of conduction do in fact occur. So this is only an approximation to real life. It is quite a good one. Now, actual lifting, you know, why would we even worry about air being lifted? Well, there's lots of mechanisms that can lift the air. What I've illustrated here are a couple of common mechanisms, which are fronts. If you have a warm front in the top picture there, what we have is warm air coming in replacing air that was cold. And that warm air being less dense than the cold air will slide up on top of it. And in sliding up on top of the cold air, it'll be lifted. And that lifting will create clouds, and more lifting will create moisture. And so you get the weather associated with a frontal zone. The same thing happens with the reverse situation of a cold front, where a wedge of cold air comes in replacing warm. These cold air wedges are a little steeper and typically move a little faster, so the air gets lifted more rapidly into higher altitudes. And so we'll discover later that means it's more likely to be an unstable form of lifting, so that those clouds build to higher altitudes and perhaps give you thunderstorms in the summer. So fronts are a common mechanism. Another one is the terrain. The technical word is orographic. So if you see orographic lifting, it means that it's being lifted by the terrain. So if you have your normal west prevailing winds here, they hit the Sierras, they get lifted up because they can't go through the mountains, they have to go over. And that lifting will create weather over the mountainous terrain that did not exist in Central Valley.
Slide 5.
So what do we mean by stability? Well, the analogy that's usually used is imagine a little marble in a dish. If you have your dish concave up, you put a little marble in there, and we roll it to one side, gravity will make it roll back down again, and so that's said to be stable. We have an equilibrium here. If we move the marble away from the equilibrium position, it wants to go back again. The opposite situation is where we put the same dish, but we put it upside down, so it's convex up, and we could very carefully balance a marble on the top. And if we don't breathe and shake the table and so forth, it'll stay there, so that's an equilibrium, but it's an unstable one, just the slightest push, and the marble will roll off the top. A situation that happens in the atmosphere is what is referred to as conditionally unstable. And this is where we've got something with a dent in it. And so if I give that marble a little push, only a small one, then it'll go uphill, roll back down again. But if I give it a big enough push, I'll get it over the ridge line, and it'll fall down, and it's an unstable situation. So in the context of the atmosphere, a region of the atmosphere is said to be stable if, on lifting a parcel of air, its immediate tendency is to sink back down when it's released. This requires that the displaced air, this parcel you lifted up, is colder and thus denser than its surroundings after you lifted it. Bottom here, we've got a balloon. A balloon rises if it weighs less than the air it displaces. if you turn on the heater and replace some of that warm air in the balloon with hotter air, then you've made the whole thing a little bit less dense, weighs less, now it'll rise. Conversely, if we let out some of that hot air and replace it with cold, it's weighs more, and it'll sink back down. So just like the balloon, an air parcel will rise or fall depending on whether it weighs more or less than the air it displaces, which is just a function of its temperature. If it's colder than the surrounding air, it's more dense, it'll sink. If it's warmer than the surrounding air, it's less dense, and it'll rise.
Slide 6.
So you could summarize that by warm air rises, but it's a little bit more complicated than that because the atmosphere is compressible. So let's just review the fundamentals here. The air pressure is just the weight of a unit area of the air above you. So if you take a column of air that's 1 square inch all the way up, and you have some way of weighing it, then you discover that that mass of air in that one square inch column weighed about 14 pounds. And so the pressure of that air on the surface of this table is 14 pounds per square inch. If I move up in the atmosphere so that I have 1 pound of air in my column, so there's 13 pounds of air above you and one pound below, then if I put some surface there, the weight it's supporting is now only 13 pounds, and so the pressure there is 13 pounds per square inch, etc. As you go up, you go higher and higher in altitude, the mass of air above is being supported by the air below, but the mass of air above is steadily decreasing, so the pressure is steadily decreasing. So each layer supports all the layers above, and the lower layers, because they have more pressure on them, are compressed more. So as you climb, the pressure drops. So let's consider a parcel of air then. We lift it up, we put it in our little saran wrap baggie, we lift it up, and it goes to a lower pressure, so it expands. And we know that when the gas expands, it cools. When you compress it, it gets hotter. You know this from pumping up your tires. You pump up your bicycle tire, the valve gets hot. Conversely, you let the air back out again, it cools down. So we've lifted this this parcel of air. It's cooler. So whether it will continue to rise after we've lifted it depends on whether, despite that cooling, it's warmer than its surroundings. And so that depends on how the actual temperature varies with altitude.
Slide 7.
So here I have a picture illustrating this. So on the left we have a stable atmosphere. Stable atmosphere is where the temperature decreases slowly with altitude. If I take my bottom parcel of air here, unfortunately my finger on the screen doesn't do much. Let's see. If I take this parcel of air and move it up, and it cools, if the temperature only decreases slowly with altitude, then that air that I've just lifted is cool on the surrounding, so if I let go, it'll sink back, and that's stable. Conversely, on the right, I take that same parcel of air, it cools the same amount, but if the temperature decreases rapidly with altitude, then the temperature surrounding that parcel is colder than the bubble I just lifted. And so it's lighter, it's warmer than its surroundings, so it'll continue to rise. So that's an unstable situation. I lift it up a bit, and whoosh, it keeps on going. So this parcel theory, then, is an idealization in which the lifted air is assumed to exchange no heat or matter with the surroundings, and it's got a fancy name, which you learned in private pilot ground school. It's called an adiabatic process. And it's only imperfectly realized in nature because there is some mixing of real air parcels with the surroundings. But it's a pretty good approximation. And it makes a tool you can actually use.
Slide 8.
So how much are these lifted? A lifted particle expands and cools. And it expands at a known rate you can measure. It's called the adiabatic lapse rate. And it depends on whether the air is dry or moist. Now, dry in this sense is a term of art. Dry doesn't mean there's no moisture in it. Dry means it's not saturated with moisture. So any air that's not saturated cools at a constant rate, 3 degrees Celsius, for every 1,000 feet you lift it. And that's a reversible process. If I take my parcel of air in my baggie and I lift it up 1,000 feet and stick a thermometer in it, it's 3 degrees Celsius colder. If I bring it back down again in my airplane, descend 1,000 feet, it compresses back up, and 3 degrees warmer back right where it started. However, the situation is different, and this is what makes weather interesting. If this wasn't true, there wouldn't really be any weather. When air is saturated, we mean 100% relative humidity, if you lift it, it expands and cools, but cooler air can't contain as much moisture, so that moisture condenses and releases what is called latent heat. This is the reverse of if you put a kettle on the stove and you put the turn on the gas, then heat it up to 100 degrees C, so now it's same temperature as steam, but you have to keep adding heat if you actually want to boil the water off. Conversely, if you condense that steam back into water, you get the heat back. And so this is called the latent heat. It's the amount of energy it takes to break the liquid water up into gaseous water, or the reverse. So this cooling that you get by expansion is offset by the latent heat. And so the moist adiabatic lapse rate, the rate at which saturated air cools when you lift it, varies with the moisture content, which depends on the temperature. So at high temperatures, where saturated air contains a lot of moisture, cooling it condenses out a lot of moisture, gives you a lot of latent heat, and so the temperature only drops a small amount. And so at high temperatures, the saturated lapse rate's about 1 degree per 1,000 feet.
Do you have a chart that would show air density versus humidity? Versus.
I don't have one right here.
I've never seen one.
You can find on my website a chart that will show you the amount of water vapor as a function of temperature. It's called the saturation vapor barrier.
Yeah, as a function of temperature, yes, but what I'm talking about is the density of air.
Yeah, well, it's trivial to calculate. You know how to do it. let's go to the other limit. Let's suppose we have saturated air, but let's suppose the air is minus 40 degrees C. Well, that air is saturated, but contains almost no moisture, because very cold air can only contain a tiny bit of moisture. So if you cool it down some more, almost no moisture condenses out, and so it's almost the same as being dry. So in the limit of low temperatures, then, the moist lapse rate is almost the same as the unsaturated rate, namely 3 degrees per 1,000 feet. So this process is typically not reversible, because suppose I take my little baggie, my saran wrap full of air up in my airplane, and I lift it up 1,000 feet, and it was moist, so the moisture condenses out. And let's suppose I let that water drain away, and then I bring it back down again. Well, that moisture is not available to be reabsorbed. And so the temperature will change as if it's dry air, because I'm not reabsorbing moisture. So this process where we're allowing moisture condense is technically not called an adiabatic process. It's referred to as a pseudo-adiabatic process. Pseudo because of the
slide
condensation.
Slide 9.
So what I've just described is actually responsible for what are called Santa Ana conditions here in California, or in the Rockies, they call them Chinooks. In Europe, they call them ferns. And they arise from this irreversibility of condensation and recompression. So let's suppose on the left side of the mountains here, we have some moist air that's at 20 degrees Celsius, let's say. And the winds are from the left to right. So the air gets lifted as it goes up the mountain range. And let's suppose that that air becomes saturated when we get to 5,000 feet. So if you remember your numbers then, if we go 5,000 feet, we're lifting unsaturated air, so it'll cool by how much? 3 degrees per thousand, so 15 degrees. So if it starts off at 20, it'll cool down to?
Like 5.
Looks like 5. Helping you out with the math. So 5 degrees C. Now we lifted another 4,000 feet, but now it's saturated air. And that saturated air cools slowly, and we'll pick a typical number between 1 and 3, let's call it 2. And so it'll cool 2 degrees per 1,000 feet, and so 4,000 feet times 2 degrees per 1,000, 8 degrees. So coming over the top of the mountain, the air will be minus 3. Well, that moisture got condensed out, and we got all this rainfall on the windward side of the mountains there. And then the air descends down the back, so down the lee side of the mountains, and it will recompress as it goes down, and therefore it'll warm up. But now it's dry air, because it doesn't have the moisture that it just got rid of on the other side. And so it'll warm up at the dry rate, which was 3 degrees per 1,000 feet, 9,000 feet, 27 degrees. So we end up at 24 degrees C. So the air that was 20 degrees C on the windward side of the mountains is 24 degrees C, much warmer on the downwind side. So those warm, dry winds that you get when we have these offshore conditions coming off the mountains, coming down towards us, the reason it's warmer and drier is this process here.
Slide 10.
So this is all about lapse rates then. Lapse rate, by definition, is the rate of decrease of some temperature with altitude. Now, there's one other one you've learned, but maybe have forgotten since, which is the so-called standard lapse rate, which is 2 degrees Celsius per 1,000 feet. And this is the one that's assumed in performance charts for your airplane. So it's a sort of reference condition. But it's totally irrelevant for weather because only on a miraculous day would the actual lapse rate be 2 degrees per 1,000 feet. It varies all over the map. Sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less. Only if you had absolutely no knowledge whatsoever would you use this as a guess.
But doesn't that come from the fact that if you average over the whole globe, that's what you get?
Well, I think it's averaging sort of over North America, roughly. It's supposed to be that. Because it's the U.S. standard atmosphere as opposed to, you know, some world standard. It's some sort of average, and it's a nice convenient thing. I mean, if you actually average, it isn't a smooth gradient, but it kind of got wobbles in it and stuff, and you don't want that in a standard. So it's just some convenient thing to choose that's somehow typical, but not what you get on any given day. So we can forget about that as far as weather is concerned. Then there's what's referred to as the ambient or the environmental lapse rate, and that refers to the actual temperature. And that's what you go out and measure by balloon launch, where they send these balloons off twice a day and they measure the temperatures and to limit them down to the ground. Or you could go up in your airplane and watch the outside air temperatures you go up. Or for the future, will be forecast by some numerical model. And then what we've just discussed are the adiabatic and pseudo-adiabatic lapse rates, which describe the rate at which a parcel cools on lifting. The 3 degrees Celsius per 1,000 feet for dry air, meaning unsaturated, and somewhere between 1 and 3 for moist air. Air parcel, that's what it's supposed to be. Yeah. So, as I mentioned, temperature soundings are made by balloon at 0 Zulu and 18 Zulu at hundreds of stations around the world, measuring, among other things, these environmental lapse rates.
Slide 11.
So, instability results then if the ambient lapse rate exceeds the adiabatic lapse rate. That is, the temperature cools more rapidly than altitude than the parcel would if you lifted it. So there's actually three situations. At a given altitude, the atmosphere is either stable, unstable, or in between, which is called conditionally unstable. So unstable means that the ambient lapse rate, that's the slope of the actual temperature with altitude, is less steep than 3 degrees Celsius per 1,000 feet. Sorry, it's unstable if you're over here. If the actual lapse rate is more steep than 3 degrees per 1,000 feet, it's for sure stable if the temperature falls off more slowly than the moist adiabatic lapse rate, or if it increases with altitude. If the temperature increases with altitude, that's called a temperature inversion. It's guaranteed to be stable. But then there's this in-between condition where it's either stable or unstable depending on its moisture content. If it was saturated, it would be unstable. If it's dry, it's not. And the interesting stuff happens with weather, where you have air that's almost saturated, you lift a little bit, suddenly it becomes saturated, and now it was stable, and now it's no longer stable. And so that's what's called conditionally unstable. Lift it a bit, and then give it a head start on going up, then it'll keep on going up. The situation of the air being, of dry air being unstable is actually an unusual one. Typically only happens near the surface in the desert in summertime. And that's because the convection that occurs because of the instability carries heat up from the surface, which tends to flatten out the lapse rate and get rid of the instability we had in the first place. So you have this very hot ground because the sun's blasting down on it. It heats the air next to the ground. Got this rapid fall off of temperature, but then this hot air rises, it mixes with the cooler air above and warms it up and brings it back to stability again.
Slide 12.
Okay, so next month what we're going to be discussing in great detail is this SKU-T diagram. And it's used to plot this information, the temperature versus altitude, not only the temperature, but also the dew point and other information, winds, on a chart that's sort of fancy graph paper that was designed to do meteorological calculations. So on this particular chart, here's the website. The red line is the temperature. The blue line is the dew point. This is actually for Livermore sometime last year.
Could you illuminate the difference between the red line and the blue line as far as what is dew point versus temperature?
Oh, sure. So temperature is what you measure with a thermometer. So temperature in this room is, you know, whatever it is, 70 degrees Fahrenheit. The dew point is the temperature to which you'd have to cool a parcel of air from this room to make moisture condense. So if the temperature is 70 and the dew point 70, then it means that the air is what? Totally saturated, right? If I cool it any, moisture will condense. So, and if the temperature and dew point are close together, then it means you only need a little bit of cooling and the moisture will condense. So that's the why one has this private pilot ground school thing, that if the temperature and the dew point spread get close together, less than about 4 degrees, then you'd expect low IFR weather. Either the ceilings will be low or the visibility will be low because of the high humidity of the atmosphere.
Slide 13.
So We'll be looking in great detail at this chart. I just want to give you a little preview of it. And so it has on the chart the dry adiabats, that is the rate at which you took a parcel and it was dry, it would climb up one of these curves. Moist adiabats, mixing ratio, temperature, pressures. Fascinating stuff, which we'll get to. But first we need to motivate you as to why you'd want to learn all this stuff. So why do we care whether the weather is stable or unstable?
Slide well, 14.
Stable and unstable air are associated with distinct weather patterns. So I've got them in two columns here. Stable on the left, unstable on the right. So the fundamental characteristic of unstable air is that if you lift it, it keeps on going up. And so because of that, you're constantly launching off updrafts where the air is going up, and somewhere else to compensate, the air has to come down. So all over the place then, you've got updrafts one place, downdrafts another, convection currents, vertical mixing of the air. And so the airflow, rather than being laminar, that is running along essentially parallel to the surface in straight lines, if it's unstable, it's wobbling up and down depending on whether you're in an updraft or a downdraft at that particular location in space. So stable, you have this laminar airflow, unstable up and down drafts. And so if you go flying, the first thing you'll notice that if it's stable, the flying is normally fairly smooth. Conversely, on an unstable day, as you go through these up and down drafts, that will bump the airplane around. The surface manifestation of this, if it's windy, is that on the ground, if it's stable, the surface winds will tend to be fairly steady. On the other hand, if there's up and down drafts, then the surface winds will be gusty depending on whether you're locally sitting right over an updraft, right over a downdraft, or on the edge, you know, depending where that is relative to the airport. Next big difference is the kind of clouds that form. On a stable day, since the air has no tendency to, if you push it up, it comes back down again, the clouds that form tend to form in flat sheets. And those kind of clouds are called the stratus clouds. Whereas on an unstable day, where the air is rising, it cools, and where it cools the dew point, cloud forms. So sitting on the tops of the updrafts, you've got clouds. And in between, where the air is descending, you have no clouds. And so these clouds that are in clumps all over the place, kind of puffy white things, those are called cumulus-type clouds. If it's stable, the visibilities have a tendency to be poor because if there's any smoke in the atmosphere, for instance, any pollution that's been piling up, then there's no updrafts to carry them up into the upper atmosphere and get rid of it. And so this stuff just accumulates. And the visibilities tend to drop, and those dust particles and car exhaust and whatever also attract moisture, which condense on it and generally bring the visibility down. Conversely, when it's unstable, then except in the clouds and precipitation, if there is any, the visibility tends to be good because the updraft is constantly mixing in fresh air from at high altitudes where the air is nice and clear. If you get precipitation, then the kind of precipitation you get from the stratus-type clouds is steady precipitation. Because remember, these clouds just exist in long, flat, horizontal sheets, and they're all pretty much the same over here as they are there. So it's raining here, it's raining there. As you fly along, you stay in the same position relative to those clouds. The rain is fairly steady. Whereas if you go flying around, just took a straight line across a day when you've got cumulus clouds dropping rain, and depending on whether you're under that cumulus cloud or not, you're either in a rain shower or you're not in a rain shower. So it's showery precipitation. If you get icing, the kind of ice that you're liable to get is somewhat different on a stable day than an unstable day. If you're flying at a level where you're getting icing on a stable day, then you'll probably keep on getting it because the conditions exist over a large lateral dimension. So if you manage to pick the altitude, which is bad, it's going to stay bad. And so you'll get continuous icing. However, because the droplets in stratus clouds are smaller than the ones that can be supported by big updrafts, the rate of accumulation isn't normally that high. And so you've got continuous icing, but it's typically light to moderate, and it only becomes a problem if you just allow it to continue accumulating for long periods. And also, the layer in which icing exists tends to be fairly limited vertically, typically about 4,000 feet or so. So climbing, you know, more than 4,000 feet from where you are in a stratus-type condition would normally be enough to get you out of those conditions. Now, everything we've just said is totally the opposite if you're flying on an unstable day, as far as ice is concerned. First of all, the icing will be intermittent, because if you're in the downdraft parts, you're not supporting any moisture and no ice, and then you fly into this cumulus where the air is rising and it's bringing up all this moisture from below, and splat, you got a bunch of ice. And those droplets can be larger in a cumulus cloud than a stratus cloud, so those droplets, when they freeze, tend to freeze more slowly, and so you have more of a tendency to get clear-type icing than you do in a stratus cloud. So you get possibly heavy clear icing, and also climbing, you're going to have to climb a lot higher to get out of it, because where the icing is in these cumulus clouds, there's convection currents carrying this moisture up from below, and it'll carry up to quite high altitudes and to colder temperatures than in the stratus situation.
Can you define ICIP for me?
Yeah.
Icing in clouds and in precipitation. Straight off the area forecast. So the main hazards then, as far as stable conditions are, you've got a good possibility of low ceilings and visibilities. Low IFR weather can occur when it's stable. When it's unstable, it's unlikely to be low IFR, but you have the potential for thunderstorms, which are, of course, hazardous. And then in either conditions, you have the possibility of icing.
Slide 15.
So, after these unrelenting word slides, we have a few pictures. So, here are some stratus clouds. So on the left, then, we're looking at a stratus deck from above and from below. Technically, stratus cloud, just a plain ordinary stratus cloud, is a stratus cloud that's at low altitude. They give them, they put a prefix on them. If they're higher, they're called altostratus if they're at the middle altitudes, and cirrostratus if they're up way beyond the surface ceilings of our airplanes. If they produce rain, then they get to be called nimbostratus, because nimbus is the Latin word for rain.
Slide 16.
So the opposite situation then are your cumulus-type clouds. The cumulus-type clouds form an unstable air. So we have a cumulus buildup in the top left there. We have a cumulus cloud looking black and glowering at night with lightning coming out the bottom. Lumpy looking formation on the right. But cumulus clouds aren't necessarily bad. They become hazardous if they grow to high altitudes, and that doesn't always happen. We'll be discussing the situations under which it will or won't. And so so-called fair weather cumulus are cumulus clouds that top out at relatively low altitudes and dodge your way around them, and it's a perfectly nice day to fly, maybe a little bumpy.
Slide 17.
So if you look at a weather report, with a few exceptions, you're not going to find out what kind of cloud it is. We look at a meter, it says, you know, 3,000 overcast, whatever. It doesn't say whether it's cumulus or stratus. Sometimes just by looking at a satellite picture, you can tell what kind of cloud you got. So up in the top left corner there, there's an Aleutian low, this bulge here, there's a cold front here, and behind it we've got the cold air of the cold Arctic air mass moving down here over the Pacific. So this cold air is coming over a relatively warm ocean, and that's an unstable situation. You're heating the air from below, and so you'll get cumulus-type clouds. So you have the rather obvious cumulus here. Here, where the front itself is coming, you've got this mass of Arctic air shoving underneath the warmer air from the middle latitudes, and there that lifting is pushing those clouds to much higher altitudes. So a big cloud band here. And over here we've got the cloud band of the associated warm front. If you look over here, over the upper Midwest, then you can see instead of being this kind of pockmarked appearance of the cumulus clouds, it's a sort of a steady gray, and that's stratus deck. It's actually hard to tell just from a visible image whether that's a stratus deck, maybe something down fairly low, or maybe it was, you know, cirrus up high. To determine that, you'd have to look at an infrared satellite image, because an infrared image tells you the cloud temperatures. And so if you see a nice, smooth, continuous cloud deck, but it's relatively warm at a temperature that's comparable to that of the ground, then you know it's down low. On the other hand, if it's a real cold cloud deck, then you know it's up high. Another thing that in the winter you have to watch for is you look at this thing and you might say, oh, look, it's cloudy over the Sierras. No, there's actually no clouds there at all. But it's hard to tell just by looking at the picture. The way I would tell is I'd run a time loop, and I would discover that these clouds do not move, whereas all these other ones do. So it's cumulogranite or cumulosnow. It's actually snow. And so you have to be able to distinguish snow cover from the snow cover too. You have to distinguish snow cover from clouds. So the easiest way to do that is from motion. Or if you get a real high resolution picture, then the snow, yeah, you can't quite see the skiers or read their license plates or anything, but you can, it has a sort of feathery kind of appearance compared to clouds.
But wouldn't, if you have winds going over a mountain range, wouldn't you expect clouds to be just...
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, they could have been clouds. They're just not. Oh, I see. If those were stationary.
And therefore, they wouldn't move because
yeah, well,
as the orographic lifting forms clouds, drops rain, and then on the leeward side, the clouds don't exist because there's no more moisture, so those cloud decks would stay parked in the weather.
Yeah, but I think they can.
I think you'd see a little bit of motion. I mean, the these things, are,
okay,
you know,
so
picture to picture, there's no change at all.
Yeah, okay.
Slide 18.
So we said before that if the air is stable, it's smooth. Well, it isn't absolutely guaranteed. Because if the air is stable, it's actually capable of supporting wind shears. Because, you know, we've got air moving along at some speed here, air moving along at some speed there. Because vertical motion is suppressed, because the air is stable, those air masses don't mix. And so you can have different wind speeds at different altitudes. So you can only get a wind shear if it's stable. But if you have a very strong wind shear, and you can generate turbulence, basically, at the interface between the two airspeeds. And if you've, you know, made instrument approaches and so forth through a wind shear, then you'll know you go down, boom, 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 boom. The needles disappear off the side of the instrument. And then you go down below because there's big wind shift and so forth as you drop down below, and the signal that everything's about to go to hell on the approach is it was beautifully smooth, and now it's turbulent. It's smooth again. So this is...
That looks like my test.
So these... it just so happens that the stationary air below is nice and moist, and so it's got these clouds in it, and then the rapidly moving air coming across from left to right is sweeping across the top of this and causing an instability at the interface, which you can actually see. And the physicist in here will recognize this as the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. So, there's another occasion when you'll have stable air and it isn't necessarily smooth, and that's when you have a mountain wave. A mountain wave is where you have at least a layer of stable air over the mountains and strong winds blowing perpendicular to the ridge lines. The air gets lifted by the mountains, pushes up against the stable air, which pushes back because it doesn't want to be lifted, it wants to come back down again. So it comes down, then bounces a few times downwind of the mountain range. So on the leeward side, then, the air is going up and down. And within that sort of sinusoidal motion, it's actually quite smooth. But you can get underneath it rotor clouds. And if there's a big wind shear, then it can be like breaking waves at the ocean where the tops go faster than the bottoms. And if those mountain waves break, then you'll get very severe turbulence within it.
Slide 19.
So how big these cumulus-type clouds grow depends on the depth of the unstable layer. If you have a relatively shallow layer of unstable air, then you can trigger some lifting, make some clouds, but the clouds can't build very high because they hit a stable ceiling. Another thing you learned in your ground school, but have maybe forgotten, is that in this kind of situation where what we have is warm, moist air rising, forming a clouds at a base here, you can calculate the bases of those clouds from the temperature dew point spread out the surface, because it takes a certain amount of cooling to make a cloud, and the bigger the temperature dew point difference is, the more cooling you need to do, the higher you need to lift it. And so the rule of thumb is you divide the surface temperature dew point spread in Fahrenheit by the magic number 4.4, and that gives you the height of the clouds in thousands of feet. So that's another source of the rule of thumb, that if the temperature dew point spread drops below 4 degrees, you've got a good chance of IFR weather, because if you form these kinds of clouds, they'd form below 1,000 feet.
Slide 20.
If we have a deep, unstable layer of air, then we have the potential for thunderstorms. So let me remind you then, thunderstorms require three ingredients. We need a deep layer of conditionally unstable air. So we have cumulus-type clouds that can build into cumulonimbus by lifting. The more moisture, the better, because it's the latent heat of condensation of the rising air that's condensing out that provides the energy that powers the storm. And lastly, we need some lifting action, because if the air is only conditionally unstable, somehow we have to get it started. So we have to lift it up enough that it becomes saturated so we can keep on going. And so that lifting mechanism depends on the situation, and they give them different names. So so-called air mass thunderstorms happen when the thunderstorms essentially occur random inside some air mass, and they're randomly triggered by something as silly as, well, you've got a big parking lot here, and that parking lot gets relatively hot in the sun, and so it produces a rising bubble of air, and that triggers off a local thunderstorm. But it's not organized in any kind of pattern. Get one here, get one there. Those are called air mass. Then we have the frontal storms. The frontal storms are where you have, for instance, a cold front, a wedge of cold air moving in, lifting the air above it. And as it gets lifted up the surface here, if it's conditionally unstable, there's a point where you've lifted it enough that it becomes saturated and therefore unstable. And once it's unstable, it says, okay, here we go, and keeps on climbing up. Squall lines typically form a few hundred miles ahead of rapidly moving cold fronts. And then you have your orographic thunderstorms. Orographic is caused by what? Lifting over terrain. So the things you get in the Sierras in the summer, those thunderstorms you get there, which you didn't have in the Central Valley, those are orographically generated.
Slide 21.
So to summarize then, atmospheric stability is determined by comparing the ambient lapse rate, that's the actual rate at which the temperature decreases at altitude, with the appropriate adiabatic lapse rate. If you determine the air is stable, then you'd expect it to be smooth, steady winds, stratus-type clouds, steady precipitation, if any, poor visibilities, prime icing. Conversely, if it's unstable, you'd expect to see bumpy air, gusty winds, cumulus-type clouds, showery precipitation, good visibilities, clear icing, perhaps.
Slide 22.
Skew T-charts plot temperature dew point soundings, and next month we'll learn how to use these to extract useful information about estimating cloud layers and tops, potential for icing, potential for thunderstorms, fog, turbulence, mountain waves. Thank you. So last week we talked about the influence of the temperature profile on the atmospheric conditions, on whether the air is stable or unstable, and whether that leads to the kind of clouds you get, the gustiness of the winds, the visibilities, etc. So that information is plotted on charts called skew T diagrams. And we'll be looking at a particular version of this, which is available on the website on the slide, rucsoundings.noaa.gov. This is an interactive plotter, and we'll learn that it's rather more convenient to use than the old graph paper that was used for many years. So on these plots, one finds the temperature. Here one sees on the right, temperature is plotted in red. Going upwards is altitude. And to the left of that is the dew point. To remind you, the dew point is the temperature to which you cool a sample of air to make it saturated. So if the air was totally saturated in the first place, the temperature would equal the dew point. If the air is relatively dry, then the dew point will be significantly less than the temperature because it takes a lot of cooling to bring it to saturation. So, as I said, the vertical axis of this plot is the altitude. They're shown by the blue horizontal lines and labeled on the right. It's 1, 5, 10, 15, 20,000 feet. And labeled on the left by the corresponding pressure. So these altitudes are, strictly speaking, pressure altitudes, what you'd obtain by setting your altimeter to 2992 and reading it. Then the horizontal axis is temperature, and those you'll see plotted along the bottom, minus 40 up through plus 40, except the constant temperature lines slant off to the right, and so that's why it's referred to as a skew T plot. We'll see this in a little more detail in a second.
Slide 23.
So if you go to the website that we referred to, the rucsoundings.noaa.gov, the opening page you'll see here on this slide, you're presented with a screen on which you get to choose the data source and the time of which you want the observation or the forecast. So at the top there's a bewildering list of choices. The one I would recommend using for normal purposes is labeled there as OP20. It's a forecast on a 13-kilometer grid, for some reason interpolated onto a 20-kilometer grid, whereas the default is that same forecast interpolated onto a coarser mesh, onto a 40-kilometer grid. So one is able to get this forecast information, which we'll talk about. You can also get observations. Ray obs, they're shown there, the sixth one down. Those are the balloon observations that are obtained by sending up weather balloons and having them telemeter down the temperature and dew point and location from which they get wind. And these are sent up every 12 hours at 00 and 1200 Zulu. So those are good if it happens to be 00 or 1200 Zulu, but if it's somewhere in between, then the forecast will give you more timely information. So then below you get to choose the time, which would normally be now, so then checking the box where it says latest will do that, or you can specify the specific time in the boxes on the right. And then below that, the number of times, if you want to forecast how many hours out into the future, like a series of forecasts. And at the bottom, a box in which you can enter the list of locations. So these can be the sites at which there are RAOB observations, if you're looking at RAOBs, or it can be a list of airports. If you're looking at the forecasts, it knows where most airports are. And even in principle, you can put in latitude-longitude pairs if you want some obscure place where there's no airport. So these forecasts are made by a computer model called the Rapid Update Cycle. That's what the RUC stands for. And the Rapid Update Cycle means that the computer model is started with new initial conditions every hour on the hour. Each hour, it incorporates the data that's come into the Weather Bureau during that hour, either in the form of RAOBs, which only come in every 12 hours, or surface observations like the METARs and satellite data. And so, since it's being constantly updated, it pretty much represents the truth at the time that the model has started, and if you don't run it very far, it probably doesn't get very far off. So this is probably the best source of data that you can get into the short range. That's a lot of forecasts to be starting a computer model every hour. So in fact, how long they run the computer depends on the hour of the day. And it's quite complicated, and I certainly don't need to memorize this, but it's right there on the slide. For a Zulu time that's not divisible by 3, in other words, initial times that are 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, 8, etc., Greenwich Mean Time, the forecast is only run for 3 hours. So you get projections at starting time 1, 2, 3 hours in advance. However, every third hour, that is at 0, 0, 0, 3, 0, 6, 0, 9, they run the forecast out longer, out to 6, 9, and 12 hours from the initial point. And then every sixth hour, so that's at 00, 06, 12, and 1800 Zulu, they run the forecasts, giving you additional outputs at 24 and 36 hours from the starting point.
Slide 24.
So these soundings give us a great deal of information about the local weather, where the sounding is, or is forecast to be. In particular, it will tell us about cloud layers, the bases and tops. We'll learn this in a second. The winds aloft are plotted on there. We can infer information about possible icing, possible turbulence, the stability of the atmosphere, potential for fog, thunderstorms, and other hazardous weather. And as I said, the air data is based on these worldwide balloon RAOB observations, which are input to numerical codes, which then produce hourly predictions thereafter.
Slide 25.
So looking at the plot in a little more detail, as I mentioned when we saw this the first time, the vertical axis is pressure altitude. The horizontal axis, you see the red lines tilting to the right, are the lines of constant temperature. That's why it's referred to as a skew T. And it's done in this rather strange manner because if the axis was done in the normal way, where 0 degrees C just represent the point that went up vertically from the bottom of the axis, since the temperature always decreases as you go up in altitude, every plot would disappear off at about 45 degree angle to the left and take up a lot more graph paper. By tilting the axes over, the soundings are roughly vertical and easier to read.
Slide 26.
So as we see on the next plot, if we plot the standard atmosphere, we can see it in fact slopes slightly to the left. In the troposphere, that's up to just over 35,000 feet. Once you enter the stratosphere, the temperature becomes constant. On a standard day, minus 56 C. This standard atmosphere is just a reference used for aircraft performance purposes, so that there's some definite atmospheric condition you can refer to, but in any given location on any given day, it's extremely unlikely that the atmosphere actually is standard. It'll be different to this. But this is what a standard atmosphere would look like, if you ever got one. And it is a temperature of 15 degrees Celsius at sea level, decreasing 2 degrees Celsius per 1,000 feet up to the tropopause. That's where the break in the curve is, where the temperature becomes constant, minus 56.
Slide 27.
So on these plots, we have the temperature and the dew point. Temperature in red, the dew point in blue. And the first thing of interest is to look at the spread. Where the temperature and dew point are close together, you can anticipate a cloud layer. In particular, if the temperature and dew point are equal, you know that the air is either was or is predicted to be completely saturated at that level. And if the air is saturated, you'd expect to see a cloud there. However, the sounding can have somewhat unsaturated air and yet still have clouds present. And that's because these plots represent the conditions averaged over a 20-kilometer square. And so if you had, say, broken clouds at some altitude, some of the air would be saturated where the clouds are, and in the gaps in between, it's not. And so when averaged over that entire layer, the air is less than saturated. So the gap, the difference, the temperature dew point depression will be a measure of whether the air, whether the clouds are overcast, broken, scattered, or no clouds at all. So in this particular example, you can see that the temperature and dew point flows together at an altitude of 8,000 feet, and that in fact corresponds to the METAR at the same time. You can see that this forecast on the bottom left says it's for 0100 Zulu on the 27th, and corresponding METAR is right there for 0055 Zulu, where it's 330 at 11 knots, 20 miles visibility, 8,000 overcast. So in this case, that layer at 8,000 feet was in fact overcast.
Slide 28.
So the temperature dew point depression then at a given altitude gives you a measure of the clouds you might expect there. And if that dew point depression, temperature minus dew point, is zero, then you can expect the clouds to be overcast. At the surface, you'd call it fog. If that dew point depression is 1 or 2 degrees C, then the expectation is that the clouds will be broken. If that dew point depression is 3 to 5 degrees Celsius, then you have scattered or few clouds. However, this is a little bit inexact. The actual spread of dew point depressions depends somewhat on the temperature. In fact, at very cold temperatures below minus 25 C, then you can have clouds even associated with temperature dew point depressions of 6 or 7 degrees C. Conversely, near the surface, when the temperatures are high, you may require somewhat smaller dew point depressions to get the same amount of clouds. Now, these considerations apply to stratus-type clouds in stable air. If the air is stable, then if you have a cloud, the cloud just sits there. If the air is unstable, then the potential is that cloud can build upwards into the drier air above. And so just because on the sounding the temperature dew point depression is large doesn't necessarily mean there's no cloud there. Potentially, it could be a cumulus cloud that built up from below. And we'll see how that works in a minute. If it's actually precipitating, raining or snowing, then as far as these SKU-Ts are concerned, the temperature dew point spread will be low even if there are gaps between the clouds. So you could have a situation where you had some clouds near the ground, a gap in which it's raining from clouds above, and then the clouds above, but there wouldn't be any fine distinction between the bases of the upper clouds and the precipitation below. It all looks saturated as far as the QT can tell.
Slide 29.
On the next slide, we have some more details on this. It's pretty dense, so I recommend just reading it if you're interested.
Slide 30.
So not only can we guess the locations of the clouds, we can actually guess their bases and tops. So on this next view graph, we have a situation where we have a cloud layer, and I've drawn two arrows to the base where the temperature and the dew point first meet, and the top where they start to split apart. And we'll learn shortly that because the temperature curve is tilting off to the right, that means it's going to be stable there, so we have a stable cap. So the tops really are tops. The clouds won't build up above that. And so reading off the SKU-T, we see the bases should be around 2,000 feet and the tops look to be about 6. And now we can read the pilot report and the METAR for the corresponding time, both of them around 1900. The pilot report was 11 minutes later. The city was over Corvallis in a Cessna 210, and he experienced cloud conditions broken 3,000, top 6,000. That's pretty close to what we estimated from the SKU-T. And the actual METAR for Corvallis 5 minutes earlier was 10 miles visibility and 3,900 broken. So, slight discrepancy. Airport wasn't exactly where the airplane was. It also wasn't exactly the same time. It was 15 minutes later. But both are in substantial agreement with the SKU-T. One thing you'll also notice is at the top, on the right, where you see all the wind arrows, where you see the wind speed and direction, you see there's a significant shift in the wind direction. That's actually quite common as you go from one stable air mass of different character. There's often a wind shift there associated with some kind of front.
Slide 31.
So if you're interested in cloud tops, you can look at all the individual SKU-Ts, but there are dedicated products that produce cloud top heights. One way of measuring them is to look down at them from above with geostationary satellites looking at the infrared radiation. And those can distinguish moisture from dry air, and the temperature gives an indication of the height. And so translated into color scale on the bottom is the top of the clouds in on a pressure scale in millibars. So you then have to go back to the previous slide to turn those millibars into altitude that you can use unless you have the table memorized.
Slide 32.
And here we see a movie of another product, the cloud tops from the rapid update cycle simulation data. That's the same stuff that goes into the METARs with additional satellite and pilot report data. And this I find a little bit more usable, though it's an experimental site, so you'll have to use the pointer given there. And it may or may not work sometime in the future.
Slide 33.
So to remind you from earlier, we were concerned about whether the atmosphere was stable, unstable, or in between, what's called conditionally unstable. And this was determined, if you recall, by the ambient lapse rate, the rate at which the temperature decreases the altitude, that's the ambient lapse rate, compared to a theoretical number, the adiabatic lapse rate. That's the rate at which a parcel would cool if it was lifted. So here we show altitude versus temperature, and the two dashed lines on here are the two adiabatic lapse rates. The one that is more vertical, falls off more slowly, is the moist adiabatic lapse rate. That's because moist air cools more slowly when you lift it, because the moisture condenses and the latent heat heats up the remaining air. The steeper curve going more steeply to the left is the dry adiabatic lapse rate. So then the three sample soundings, the green one, the yellow one, the red one, the green sounding, where the temperature is to the right of both adiabatic lapse rates, is stable. And so lifted air here, it would cool adiabatically, end up colder than its surroundings, and so it would sink back down again. The red curve is the opposite situation, where the temperature is falling more rapidly than the dry adiabatic lapse rate. So here, if you lifted some air, its temperature would be warmer than the surrounding air, so it would continue to rise. So this is a situation that you can't sustain for any length of time, because air near the surface wants to keep rising and mix with the cooler air above, driving the lapse rate back towards the adiabatic one. So in practice, these completely unstable soundings are only found close to the surface in the desert in the summer, where there's a lot of heating from below. The most common situation, and the one that is most interesting from the weather point of view, is where we have a lapse rate that is in between the two adiabatic lapse rates. That is, falling off faster than the moist adiabatic rate, but falling off slower than the dry adiabatic rate. This is said to be conditionally unstable. It is stable as long as the air remains dry. But if by some mechanism, either by lifting the air, cooling it, or adding moisture to it, you make it saturated, then it is unstable. So you lift at the point where it becomes saturated, then it'll continue rising. So little diagrams on the right, the stable marble, push it to one side, it'll roll back to the middle. Unstable marble, doesn't matter how small amount you push it, it'll fall off. Conditionally stable, you have to push it up a hill, but once you've pushed it far enough, then it'll fall off. That's your conditionally unstable situation.
Slide 34.
So, these adiabats are shown on the SKU-T plot. So, the sort of orangey ones are the moist adiabats. Curved, highly curved. The almost straight ones, the blue ones going off to the left, are the dry adiabats. And so we can use this SKU-T chart like a little computer. We can have it tell us what happens to a parcel if we lift it. So if we start with a parcel at 800 millibars and a temperature of 20 degrees C, that's where the circle is on the plot. And first, let's assume it's dry. It's dry, and we lift it, and we lift it up to the 600 millibar level. Then it'll follow a dry adiabat, and so it'll end up at the tip of the blue arrow. And we can read off the temperature that it'll end up at by following the red arrow down to the temperature scale. Apparently, it'll cool down from 10 degrees to about minus 12. On the other hand, if that same parcel of moisture was moist, that is, it's totally saturated, then when you lift it, it'll go up on the orange curve. At the 600 millibar level, it'll end up at the tip of the orange curve. And we read that off down the red arrow. It would cool down to only minus 2. So you can see there's a considerable difference. If you lift moist air, the temperature drops 12 degrees. If that same air was dry, the temperature drops 22 degrees.
Slide 35.
So in reality, some parcel is probably partially has some moisture, but is not totally saturated. And so if we continue to lift it, initially as we lift it, it will cool on the dry adiabat, and it'll continue cooling on that curve until it becomes saturated. Once the lifted parcel becomes saturated, then from that point on, it'll remain saturated, and its trajectory on this SKU-T plot will follow the moist adiabat. So the purple curve here represents a parcel that starts at sea level with a temperature, looks like about minus, that's probably plus 37. If you lift it, getting up to around 620 millibars, it's cooled down to just below freezing, and it becomes saturated. Then as you continue to lift it, it continues up the the purple curve. So this can clearly be done by hand, drawing in the lines following these curves on the plot. That is somewhat intricate work. The SKU-T plot provided on that RUC soundings site does it automatically. If you click anywhere on the left click anywhere on the chart, it'll draw the purple line telling you what a parcel starting from the point where you clicked, what its temperature would be as you lifted it up in altitude.
Slide 36.
So that leaves one question, which is, well, how do you know at what point the moisture parcel becomes, the parcel of air becomes saturated when you lift it? Where does that curve kink from leaving the dry adiabat onto the moist one? Well, that must depend on how much moisture it started with. If it started with a lot of moisture, it was almost saturated, then you'd only have to lift it a little bit in altitude and then it would become saturated. Conversely, if it started off relatively dry, you'd have to lift it a long way. And so it's determined by the dew point at the dew point of the parcel, at the point from which you lift it. And that's the what the purpose of the remaining gray lines on the chart tilting to the right. They are lines of constant mixing ratio, constant mixture of moisture to air, and they represent how the dew point changes as you lift the parcel. So in this instance, we're taking our parcel. It's starting off with a temperature of 25 degrees. Dew point is minus 4. The dew point follows the black arrow, paralleling the gray curves on the chart. The temperature follows the purple curve, following the dry adiabats. When they meet, then the temperature and the dew point have met. So at that point, the air is saturated. So from that point on, the curve continues along the moist adiabat. So if we look at this, if we click on the plot, in this case a surface parcel, then we can immediately tell whether that air is stable or unstable. If the purple line is to the left of the red one, that is the lifted temperature is colder than the ambient temperature, then we know if you lifted the parcel, it would be colder, it would be more dense, so it would sink back down. So if the purple line is to the left of the red one, it's a stable situation. Conversely, if the purple line drifts to the right of the temperature curve, the red one, then it must have been unstable.
Slide 37.
So on the next view graph, we see an example of an unstable profile, a very unstable one. This was a profile taken at 0100 Zulu at Jackson, Tennessee, MKL on this date. And about 30 minutes later, they had a tornado go through the town. So it must have been unstable. How do we tell that? Well, if we click on a surface parcel, we can see the purple line come up. And we can see there's a large range of altitudes between 800 millibars up to about 200 millibars, where such a lifted parcel would be considerably warmer than the environment. And so if you give a parcel near the surface a little bit of a kick up to the 900 millibar level, then from then on it'll keep on rising. Well, that's what gives you the large vertical development you see in a thunderstorm. Wide range of altitude where the air is potentially unstable. The area between the temperature curve and the lifted parcel curve, that is between the red one and the purple one, where the purple one is to the right, that area is a measure of how much energy a lifted parcel will get from the buoyancy forces. Now we can see this because at any given altitude, the difference in temperature between the parcel and the ambient temperature is a measure of the difference in density, so it's a measure of the buoyancy force. It's like the amount of lift a balloon has depends on the difference in the temperature of the air inside its envelope to the air outside. So the lift force is proportional to this difference, The vertical axis is height, so the area in here is force times height, which is work, and so this is a direct measure of the energy. And so it's got a name that suggests that. This area is called the CAPE, or the convective available potential energy. And they calculate it for you. They put it on the right-hand side of the plot, right at the top. In this case, the convective available potential energy was 3,915 joules per kilogram. So the bigger this number is, the more unstable the air is. And as a rule of thumb, it's been found that if the CAPE is between 0 and 1,000, that's sort of marginally unstable. 1,000 to 2,500, moderate. 2,500 to 3,500, very. And 3,500 plus, extremely unstable. So we're in the extreme category here. And so we're not too surprised when we got tornadoes. So there's some other interesting things here, which is, well, I've got this parcel at the surface. Initially, if I lift it, you can see the purple line is, starts off just slightly to the left of the red line. So that initial lifting requires some force. Something has to come along and do it. So you could have a cold front, or there could be just some region on the ground which is a little bit warmer than the average temperature here, and therefore the curve would be further over to the right. Or there could be some mechanical lifting. There could be a range of hills that, with the wind, prevailing winds, help lift the air up to the point where it becomes unstable, where the purple curve first goes to the right of the red one. So that point is called the level of free convection, LFC here. That's also calculated for you on the right-hand side. So that tells you basically how much lifting you have to provide in order to trigger the instability. And so if you see a bunch of little cumulus clouds down there at low level, but you've got this extremely high CAPE, then you know that if those cumulus clouds have ever punched through the level of free convection, then they'll just keep on going up, and they'll go up at least to the point where the temperature and dew point meet again, which is called the equilibrium level. So that's up here at about 200 millibars. And it's shown on the right, 196 millibars, to be more precise.
Slide 38.
So in an unstable profile, then, in general, starting from the surface, your purple line will start off to the left of the temperature profile, and then go to the right of it. Where it's the left, the air is stable. Where it's the right, it's unstable. Two areas. The unstable area, we said, was called the CAPE. That's the convective available potential energy. The other area is important. It's called the convective inhibition, CIN. That gives you a measure of how much energy the lifting processes have to provide in order to trigger the thunderstorm. So the smaller that is, the less it's going to take. In this particular example, where we're in Rapid City, the convective inhibition is quite high. And so, say, well, that doesn't look too bad. But in fact, out to the west, there's a cold front. And a few hours later, that cold front came through, wedged the air up near the surface, lifting it through this convective inhibition, and triggered a bunch of thunderstorms, despite the initially low CAPE.
Slide 39.
The SKU-T log P plot that we've been looking at is also a great tool to check on potential icing conditions. And if you recall, you can get structural icing on the on your airframe if the temperature of the airplane is below freezing, which normally requires the outside air temperatures to be above freezing, since they pretty much equilibrate, and visible moisture in the atmosphere, that is either a cloud, little tiny moisture droplets, or precipitation. That moisture can then stick to the airplane and build up on it as a layer of structural ice. So the SKU-T is a great tool because it's got both the all the information we need. It's got the freezing levels. So where the outside air temperatures are above freezing, we should not expect any icing conditions. Where it's below freezing, then we have that potential as long as there's moisture. The SKU-T also shows the possibility of multiple freezing levels. if you go to an area forecast or many of the freezing level graphics, they'll just give you one number for the freezing level. Let's say the freezing level is 3,000 feet. What they mean by that is the lowest freezing level is 3,000 feet. And they won't say whether there's more than one. And more than one, we'll find, is important because that makes freezing rain a possibility where you can get severe icing.
Slide 40.
So here's a skew T plot that I found that corresponded to a current icing pilot report. So the pilot reported that he was over Eugene. He was actually the Eugene 160 radial at 15 miles at 0107 Zulu at 10,000 feet. He was in a beach 99. Temperature was minus 7. And he experienced moderate clear icing. So we're looking at the skew T for Eugene at 0000 Zulu, so that's an hour earlier, but presumably didn't change much. And the red curve is the temperature, and where it's to the left of the black line, which I've drawn in, is the 0 degree isotherm. Everywhere above that altitude, so that's above about 4,000 feet, is below freezing. So we have the potential for icing as long as there is potential for clouds. And, well, you might say, well, the temperature dew point spread here is actually somewhat small, around 800 or 900 millibars, so it might be clouds there, but then they widen apart. And so if you weren't careful, you might conclude there's only clouds down around 800 millibars, but that's not true because you should check for the instability. We click on the at the base of the temperature, then we'll draw the parcel trajectory from the surface, and we'll see the purple line actually is just slightly to the right of the red one. So as seen here, everywhere between 900 feet up to 900 millibars up to about 600 millibars, the air is unstable, so clouds that form at the lower level potentially grow up to here. So we'd expect cumulus type clouds then between 900 millibars or about 3,000 feet up to where the purple line leaves the red one. That's around 14,000 feet. And cumulus type clouds and below freezing temperatures you can associate with some kind of clear icing. Well, that's all consistent. He got moderate clear icing at 10,000 feet, right in the middle of this layer that we're discussing.
Slide 41.
On the next plot, we have a sounding that we'll discover indicates freezing rain. So on the left, we have the full skew T plot, going all the way up from the surface up to 150 millibars. But if you draw a box with your mouse on the skew T, you can zoom in on any portion you want. And we're interested in the lower levels here. So on the right is the zoom. And we see that the temperature and dew point are pretty much glued together up to an altitude of about 22,000 feet. So we've got high humidity all the way up here, cloud layer or possibly just precipitation, it's hard to tell. Up above 22,000, then the temperature and dew point split quite rapidly. The temperature goes off to the right, indicating that it's stable, so you've got a stable cap on whatever clouds might be here. If we look at the tops of these clouds, then we can run down and read off the temperature. It's about minus 22. And we'll learn in a minute that the cloud tops are below about minus 10, then you'd expect precipitation to be snow rather than freezing drizzle. So we got a deep layer of cold clouds here, which are producing precipitation probably, and that precipitation will be snow. So the snow will then fall down until it reaches the freezing level, which is where we cross the black line here at an altitude of about 8,000 feet. And the snow will then drop into above freezing air. And so that snow will start to melt. Close to the freezing level, you'd experience it as wet snow. That's snow that is that won't stick to the wings or tail, but could clog up your air intake as a sort of as wet snowballs. Well, the snow will eventually melt. How fast it melts depends on just how much warmer the atmosphere is than the atmosphere above. But roughly speaking, 1,000, 1,200 feet or so, that wet snow layer will turn into rain. So then we have rain down from 6,000, 7,000 feet, dropping down to where the temperature now drops below freezing again at an altitude of about 5,000 feet. Between 5,000 feet and the surface, we can see the temperature is below freezing. And so we have rain dropping down into below freezing air, which is the recipe for freezing rain. So if we look at the meters from below, we've got a series of them at 1337, 1326, 1252 Zulu, all around this time of this 1300 sounding, and they report respectively light freezing rain, and light freezing rain.
Slide 42.
Freezing drizzle mostly, frequently at least, occurs when the entire stratus cloud is below freezing. So here we're looking at a SKU-T plot indicating freezing drizzle, and we'll see how we infer this. First of all, the temperature and the dew point are glued together between about 500 feet and about 800 feet. So the air is saturated there. We can expect to see a cloud layer. At the top of the cloud layer, the temperature and the dew point rapidly split. The temperature goes off to the right, indicating a stable cap. And so we will have stratus-type clouds. We could confirm this by left-clicking on the parcel at the base, and we'll see our purple line disappearing off to the left of the temperature dew point curves. So it'll be a stratus-type cloud. The temperature and dew point are both to the left of the zero-degree isotherm, so the temperatures are everywhere below freezing. So we have about 8,000 feet of cloud, quite enough to create precipitation. But when we look at the cloud top temperature, that is the temperature at the point where the temperature of the dew point meet, we read that off on the bottom scale, we see that's about minus 7 degrees C, and that is warmer than the minus 10 degrees C that is necessary to create a significant number of ice crystals in the cloud. Without any ice crystals, or somebody flying along with silver iodide and dropping it into the clouds to create to seed them, then the ice crystals, even there aren't any, can't grow, so the moisture remains in the form of supercooled water droplets, which eventually grow by the rather inefficient process of colliding with each other and coalescing. So it's inefficient in the sense that the drops never get very large, so they never fall very fast. You create drizzle drops, tiny drops that are much larger than the drops within clouds, but they're much smaller than your typical raindrop. But nevertheless, plenty large enough to create significant ice layers on your airplane. So inside this cloud then, between 500 feet and 800 feet, we'd expect to encounter these super cool drizzle droplets. These are the conditions that crashed the ATR in Roselawn, Illinois, and spawned a whole lot of research that allows us to know more about this than we did before. And it's a counterexample to the often heard rule of thumb that if you encounter freezing precipitation, then climbing will put you in warmer air, will melt it off. In this case, we can see that the temperature never drops below, above, never goes above freezing as you climb. Assuming you could climb, you get up into the dry air, but it would never be above freezing. One last point, we should check that at high altitudes, the temperature and dew point don't come back together again. If they did, over a sufficient altitude, then we could create precipitation up at high altitude, which would be snow because it'd be cold. It would fall down into these super cool clouds below, and that snow falling from the clouds above would strip out the super cool moisture below. Here, that's not the case. The air is completely dry above the cloud tops.
Slide 43.
So now we see a SKU-T characteristic for fog. Fog is just a cloud at ground level, stratus cloud at ground level. So what we would expect to see then would be the temperature of the dew point together all the way to the surface with a stable profile. Here we see the temperature dew point going to the right, which is stable. So fog at the surface. And that is indicated also on the corresponding METAR, 40254, so that's 54 minutes later. It was a quarter mile visibility in light snow and freezing fog. Okay, well, temperature is a little below freezing. We got a stable cloud layer. Never, in fact, goes below, goes above freezing. Cloud top temperatures look to be about minus 11, so that's kind of marginal. You know, minus 10 was the dividing line, but it's rather a soft dividing line. So you could get snow, you could get drizzle, and in fact, you're sort of getting both. You're getting light snow and freezing fog. Either way, you can expect ice and climb as well as the fog.
Slide 44.
And now we have a picture of a SKU-T plot corresponding to a mountain wave. Classic mountain wave scenario is where you have a stable band of air above the ridge tops with an adiabatic layer above and below. An adiabatic layer is one where the temperature follows a dry adiabatic. So the adiabatic layers are neutrally stable. That is, if I lift some air, it neither wants to rise nor fall. So it's a very, very soft sort of spring. No restoring force in either direction. The stable layer, on the other hand, has a strong restoring force. So it's like you have two soft springs with a stiff string in the middle. But if you can set that wiggling, it can wiggle at big amplitude because there's not much to bring it back. So you can set it wiggling by having strong winds blowing approximately perpendicular to the ridge tops. So on the left, we see in cross-section the Sierra Nevada. The winds are from the west. The air gets lifted following these streamlines, and you can see it bounces up and down several times downstream of the mountain range. And it's that bouncing up and down that we experience as a mountain wave. So the criteria are then a stable layer above the ridge height, sandwiched between two adiabatic layers. It's also good to have the wind direction not changing significantly with height, and also to be approximately perpendicular to the ridge line. So that's just a sample of things that you can learn from the SKU-T. It's a great tool, but you should remember it's not the primary source of weather information. You should go to the traditional sources first, to the METARs, the TAFs, the pilot reports, etc. Then the SKU-T can be quite valuable to fill in some of the unknowns, for instance, tops, and also to make some assessment of why the forecast is the way it is. You should remember that the numerical models don't handle precipitation very well, that it's hard to get intermediate bands of dry air between moist layer. It tends to, if there's precipitation in between, it thinks the whole thing is moist. So although you can get tops and bases, sometimes it's hard to resolve multiple layers if the precipitation. So here are some useful links. You can go to my website where there's a whole bunch of other sources. There's a meteorologist name is Jeff Habby, who has a whole series of articles on different aspects of weather forecasting and weather, and he has half a dozen of them on different kinds of SKUTs. You can go to Chesapeake Aviation Training. There's a meteorologist there, Scott Denstite, who used to be a research meteorologist, now is trying to make a living as a CFII, makes you wonder. He offers weekend and net courses on weather. You can go to the University Center for Atmospheric Research. That's the home of the Comet Meteorology Education and Training courses. A lot of interesting modules there. They're all free. And then there are a couple of manuals here, the U.S. Air Force and National Weather Service manuals for QT Log P. Good luck. I tried reading them. They're pretty tough. And if you're mathematically inclined, the algorithms are all there in this last reference. So I would recommend that if you want to use the SKUT, then you should practice a bit. When you get a weather forecast, also check the SKUTs, see what you conclude from them. Go out and fly, see if it actually worked out. And once you've validated that you're actually reading these things in a sensible fashion, then you can start using it to make decisions that have potential consequences.